Now, if you remember last week, we were in chapter 7, and the Lord was talking to the Pharisees and explaining to them, and to us, of course, that it was not what you put in your mouth that defiles you, but rather what comes out that defiles you, because all the evil in the world comes from the heart and the thoughts of men, of which there is plenty of evil going on in the world today. So you can tell what's going on inside the hearts of men. There's only evil continually in their mind. Yeah, so after that, we start off in Mark chapter 7, verse 24 this evening, and we find the Lord trying to get a little privacy. So he enters into a house which is on the border of Tyre and Sidon, which is there in Syria. And I also got some notes here about Sidon, which is the chief city of Phoenicia. The Phoenicians, you've heard of them before. And of course, this is in Syria. And so you kind of get an idea of the people that are being dealt with. And the reason being is because a particular woman is going to prevent the Lord especially from getting any privacy while he's trying to hide in this house. So the Sidonians, the people of the city of Sidon, just a little north of Tyre, right there on the coast, were not just referred to as people of Sidon, but also as Phoenicians. And the Phoenician capital changed from Tyre to Sidon, and Sidon was also known as Zidon at one point, and it was built by Noah's great-grandson, Zidon. So it's an ancient city. And it's just about 25 miles north of Tyre. So if you're looking there on the map, you kind of get an idea of how many miles apart that is. It's within the limits. Sidon is within the limits of what we think of as the promised land. So you know what God has originally promised to Abraham lies within those limits. But if the Israelites themselves had never possessed that particular parcel of land. Reason being is because the tribe of Asher, to whom it was assigned, never drove out the people that lived there, and so you know it had always been pagan. Jezebel, that's a famous name, of course. King Ahab of Israel was married to Jezebel, and of course Jezebel, I think we talked about her on Sunday, either this last week or the week before. But at any rate, Jezebel is the one who introduced Baal worship to the people of Israel, and so she came. She was of the Canaanite lineage, and specifically there from Sidon and a Phoenician. She was the daughter of the king of Sidon. At any rate, we're going to run into what's called a Syro-Phoenician woman. Syro-Phoenician woman. And this whole area here, of course, we're going to find out the Lord visited this. Paul also visited through this area, and his last trip through here was on his way to Rome as a prisoner, and he was allowed to visit his friends in the city of Sidon. You can read about that in Acts 27, verses 1-3. So, this is not a unknown city or anything of that nature, and I thought maybe I'd just kind of give you a flavor for the people who lived there before we went on, so you kind of get an idea of where the Lord is at this moment. And we read in Mark 7:24, and from thence he arose and went into the borders of Tyre and Sidon, and entered into a house, and would have had no man know it, but he could not be hid, for a certain woman, whose young daughter had an unclean spirit, heard of him, and came and fell at his feet. Now, Gentiles in the Bible, by the way, were often called Greeks, and they're kind of lumped together as the name Greeks is just a general term. We read this in Paul uses the same terminology in Romans 1:14. He says, "I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians." Again, in verse 16, the gospel is to go to the Jew first and also to the Greek. It doesn't mean to the Jew and then only those who are Greeks, but rather to the Jew and then to the Gentile. So Greek is a term used to mean Gentile. So she was a Gentile. But specifically, the woman was Phoenician. And the Phoenicians were Canaanite in descendancy. And living in Syria, so she was of the Canaanite lineage, but she was specifically a Phoenician, but she was living in Syria, so what the Jews called her was a Syrian Phoenician, so Syro-Phoenician, and so that's where that name comes from. And Mark says as much in verse 26, the woman was a Greek, so a Gentile, a Syro-Phoenician by nation. And she besought him that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter. So that's how that all comes to be, and that's who she's identified as. Now, Matthew has just a little bit more information. And in Matthew 15:22, he says, "Behold, a woman of Canaan." So a Canaanite woman, of course, came out of the same coast and cried unto the Lord, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil." So Matthew adds a little bit more information, which is important information to understand the understanding of this Syrophoenician woman. Again, you know, Mark gives the pertinent details. Matthew sort of fills in a few of the blanks. And what Matthew is driving at here by filling in the blanks is that this woman's faith was on display because she knew who she was talking to when she addressed the Lord. By saying, first she says, "O Lord," and then specifies, of course anybody could be Lord over you, but she then specifies who she understood the Lord to be. She says, "O son of David." And that narrows it down considerably because we read, for instance, in the writings of Paul, Romans chapter 1, verse 1, how Paul specifies who he is about to write about in the book of Romans. When he starts the book, he says, "Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, and separated under the gospel of God." So, which God, which gospel, who is the apostle of? Well, he's about to tell you. And he says, which God, of course, had promised before by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. So, this person that he's about to write about is someone who was prophesied by the prophets in the Holy Scriptures, and then Paul narrows it down even further and said it's concerning his son, Jesus Christ our Lord, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. And so the prophets prophesied in the Scriptures about the Lord, who was a descendant of the seed of David. And that's exactly what this Syrophoenician woman knew about the Lord, that he would in fact be a descendant of David. And she says as much. So she knew who she was talking to. She knew that this was the Son of God, and she put that faith on display and her knowledge on display. Well, so here's the 12 apostles, or disciples as they're called here, and she'd been bugging them, wanting to talk to the Lord. And they didn't want anything to do with her because, of course, she's a Syrophoenician woman. Being a woman is bad enough. But the 12 didn't want to bother with her. And when here's a wonderful example of how God works. Oftentimes we pray for something, and many people don't believe prayer works because they ask God in prayer for something to happen. And then they wait and they wait, nothing happens. And so they decide, first of all, maybe God doesn't hear us. Second of all, maybe God doesn't answer prayers. Third, maybe they say, well, God's answer is no, I'm not going to do that for you. It could be any of those things. Or maybe fourth answer is, well, there is no God, so I'm not going to pray anymore. Who knows what the answer might be. But they pray once, and nothing happens, and so, well, that's that. And here is a perfect example of what we should really do, and there's a lesson that we can all learn. Because the woman comes to the Lord, and she besought Jesus that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter. And what, in fact, does she run into? She runs into 12 apostles who say, get out of here, we don't want to bother with you. So there's the first barricade set in her way. She doesn't let that bother her at all. It's sort of like knocking at the church door. I've got to come in because I've got to talk to somebody who knows about the scriptures. Well, everybody's gone. It's time to go home. We're locking up the church. The lights are already out. Every excuse out of the world. No, I've got to talk to somebody. And you're not going to let that stop you. Well, at any rate. So she doesn't take no for answer from all 12 of them. Then she gets to the Lord. So he answers her not a word meantime. There's the barricade put up by the Lord. He hears her whining. He hears her asking. And he answers her not a word. Oftentimes our prayers are answered by God with that very same response, aren't they, Mike? God answers us not a word. In the meantime, what do we hear from others? Well, I prayed and didn't get any response from God. And so what do we get from other people? Well, the answer would be no. Well, God didn't hear your prayers, or maybe there's secret sin in your life, or 100 other excuses why the prayer wasn't answered. Isn't that right? And that's where the disciples came in, and his disciples came and besought him, saying, send her away, for she crieth after us. But that should not be the end of the story. It should not be the end of your prayer. It shouldn't be the end of you beseeching God for what you know He can do for you. You see, in verse 24, Matthew 15:24, but she answered and said, I'm sorry, but here comes another roadblock. Jesus answered and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep in the house of Israel. Here's another roadblock put in the way. God answers, but it's not the answer that you're looking for. First, he doesn't answer at all. Then you get all the opinions of everybody around you. Well, he's not going to answer every other thing in the world. And then you get an answer, and it's not the answer you're looking for. I'm not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and you're not in that group, so sorry about your luck. What do you do? Well, I guess I'm out of luck. I guess I should quit praying. Absolutely not. Her response was one of absolute faith and one of absolute dependence on God. And I'm not going to give up. Because and she came and worshipped him, Matthew 15:25, saying, Lord, help me. So rather than giving up, rather than saying I'm defeated, she came and worshipped him. Just like what Mark said, there was a certain woman, and she came and fell at his feet. She worshipped him. That's her response to, Well, you know, all my miracles are for someone else. She worshipped him. When you read that, it reminds me of another place in the Bible. It reminds me of how trials and tests of faith are something that God uses to see whether we really have the faith that we ought to have. And if we don't have the faith that we ought to have, how we should be building faith until we can come to a complete reliance on Him. Because that's really what you're looking at, isn't it? She had no way to cure her daughter. There was no magic potion anywhere. There was no doctor that could come and drive the evil spirit out of her daughter. What else did she have to do but depend on God? You know, in the very first chapter of Job, some time ago we studied Job, but it reminded me so much when she came and worshipped and fell at his feet and said, "Lord, help me." It reminded me that it is not what happens to you, but rather how you respond that really makes the difference. And such is the case with Job. And in Job 1:14, there came a messenger under Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, "The fire of God has fallen from heaven, and hath burned up the sheep and the servants, and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, "The Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the swords, or fell upon the camels, and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee." And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, "Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell thee." And you know, you think, what else could possibly happen to one person in minutes? And you're talking about literally minutes. No longer than it took me to read that to you, four people show up and announce, "Guess what, Job? Your entire world has caved in on you." And what is the response of Job? And then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. It's not what happens to us, it's how we respond that matters. This woman is in desperate need in a situation that she has no alternatives. And she's told that she's not worthy because of who she is. Straight from the Lord's mouth. Jesus says unto her, Mark 7:27, "Let the children first be filled. For it is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it unto the dogs." What he just said was, I'm sent to the Jews. I'm sent to God's own people. It's not right to take what's theirs, the healings, the miracles, all the blessings that have been promised to them. It's not right to take those and give them to a Canaanite. Now, you or I probably would have argued with the Lord and said, you know what? I know a lot of Jews. And frankly, they're crooks. I live next to a Jewish family, and they're the most crooked people that you ever want to meet. They have parties at their house every weekend. They're loud, they're obnoxious, and they cheat and steal at every chance. Matter of fact, they'd rob their own family if they turned their head. But that's not what the woman said at all. She didn't put up a defense. She didn't argue. She did nothing at all. But rather, the woman is in complete agreement with what the Lord just said. Yes, they're the ones who deserve the very best and the very first from you. And she's willing to take the crumbs that fall off the table rather than to sit at the table and eat the bread that's served on the plate. And she answers, verse 28, and said unto him, yes, Lord, yet the dogs under the table eat of the children's crumbs. I don't know about you, but we have dogs at my house, and we also have grandchildren. And the grandchildren, there's more food fall on the floor than what gets in their mouths. And the dogs are always under the dining room table. Every time I read that verse, a chuckle comes to my face, because if you've ever seen the proceeds of what goes on at the dining room table, you know how true a statement that is. But you think about that. And here's a woman willing to place herself in the spot of a dog, licking up the crumbs off the floor. As far as the blessings go, taking whatever he has left over, whatever falls off the table by accident, all these hindrances that were put in her way, all the stumbling blocks that were designed to make her go away, did nothing more than make her more determined, and did nothing more than strengthen her faith. I know that. Because of her faith, Matthew 15:28 says, you're great as your faith, woman. And because of her faith, the Lord grants the healing of her daughter. Mark 7:29-30, the Lord says unto her, for this same, because you were willing to take anything that God would give you, for this saying, go thy way. The devil is gone out of thy daughter. And when she was come to her house, she found the devil gone out, and her daughter laid upon the bed. What a wonderful instance of not only grace, but the woman humbling herself in front of God. Not demanding action, but humbling herself and telling God, it doesn't matter what I did. I'll take whatever it is you have for me. Oftentimes, when we pray, we say, this is what I demand. That's what our prayers consist of. God, I want you to do this for me or that for me. And I need this. I have to have that. But the fact of the matter is that we need to humble ourselves and let God make the decision for us, not we making the decision for God and expecting Him to abide by what we have in mind. Jesus then decides to leave where He is. And he leaves the coast and ends up very close to Decapolis, which is also, by the way, on your map. Mark 7:31, and again, departing from the coasts of Tyre and Sidon, he came unto the Sea of Galilee through the midst of the coasts of Decapolis. So from the distance, you see it was a good distance. So this covers a number of days, even possibly a week or more, the distance covered. My guess is probably somewhere upwards of 50 miles, more than, and possibly more than that, walking distance. So depending on how good his sandals were, how fast his sandals were moving, but that's the happens so often in the Bible where you leave one verse and go into the next. It seems like, well, 5 minutes later he was, you know, from one place to the next, but time passed between the two events. So he's on the coast of the Sea of Galilee, and they bring unto him, verse 32, one that was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they beseech him to put his hand upon him. And he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers into his ears, and he spit and touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and saith unto him, Ephphatha, and that came out probably a lot better than I ever imagined it would, that is, be opened. That's in the Greek language. And straightway his ears were opened, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spake plain. And he charged them that they should tell no man. That's how you know, of course, that he was amongst Jews, because he said, don't tell anybody. But the more he charged them, so much the more a great deal they published it, and were beyond measure astonished, saying, he hath done all things well. He maketh both the deaf to hear and the dumb to speak. Now, this instance, by the way, we'll say a few more things about this particular instance of miracles in a moment, but I wanted you to know that this healing of the deaf and dumb man, mute, almost mute, he was in a bad speech impediment, was also the fulfilling of prophecy in the Old Testament. We won't take a look at the prophecies surrounding the verses that were fulfilled, but in Isaiah chapter 35, verses 5 and 6, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out in streams in the desert. So the prophetic word about the deaf ears hearing, the eyes of the blind being opened, the tongue singing, that was fulfilled. And there was another part of the prophecy, a lame man leap as a hart. I wonder if that was fulfilled. Well, Jesus is fixing to feed 4,000. We remember he fed 5,000 with a few loaves and a couple of fishes. Well, we'll get to dinner here in just a minute. But prior to the miracle of the feeding, I wanted you to know that Matthew also writes about the miracles and that occurred that particular day. Mark talks about the man who his ears and his tongue were healed, but Matthew also writes about some other miracles that occurred, and they were miracles that fulfilled the prophecy about the lame man shall leap as a hart. possibly some of the most amazing miracles other than the raising of the dead. Matthew 15:29-30, Matthew says, "And Jesus departed from thence," that of course being the borders of Tyre and Sidon, "and came nigh unto the Sea of Galilee, and went up into a mountain and sat down there. And great multitudes came unto him, having with them those that were lame, blind, dumb, maimed, and many others, and cast them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them." Now I want you to realize that we have read about some miracles that were truly amazing. We've seen Jesus multiply food, and we're going to see that again here shortly. Where speaking as one who has supported Kroger's and Meijer's and other grocery stores for years and years now, frankly, I'd like the loaves of bread in my cupboard to multiply and the meat in the freezer to overflow. That would be very nice. Walking on water would be a great thing. It'd be very useful. And Jesus did that, and even Peter walked on the water until he came to the realization of what he was doing. That, of course, made him start to sink. Jesus has done incredible miracles, and frankly, here comes another that just bends the mind when you think about it, I suppose. Because people who had lost limbs had them physically restored to their body in the sight of men. Mark, if you didn't notice, in verse 37, the reason that these miracles were published a great deal, Mark says, "And they were beyond measure astonished." Being astonished beyond measure, the King James Bible has has almost a gift for understatement in the language. But you have to realize, beyond measure astonished is being astonished beyond measure. So there is no being able to measure how much they were astonished at seeing what they saw. Well, let me read and I'll tell you what they saw. In Matthew 15:31, "He healed them insomuch that the multitude wondered when they saw the dumb to speak, the maimed to be whole." The maimed are those who had lost limbs. The maimed are those who had had things like legs and feet and arms and hands cut off of their bodies, and the Lord was able to restore those limbs back onto their bodies in plain sight of the multitude. "The lame then to walk and the blind to see, and they glorified the God of Israel." When you think about, when you consider and think about what God has, does, and will be able to accomplish, we're soon going to run into a verse that is probably very offensive to many when they read it. Mark has a description of hell, where your worm dieth not, and that has been deleted out of many Bibles because it was just too blooming offensive. But I think that's Mark 9:44. That's one of the times when that occurs. But Mark 9:43, because it is so offensive and so bloody and so just over the top ridiculous to so many people, they just find it beyond belief that anyone could possibly even consider following the doctrine that is set forth in Mark 9:43. But frankly, when you understand what it is that God is capable of doing, I think reflecting on what we just read makes the doctrine to be more understandable, if not acceptable. Here, we're going to sooner or later run into Mark 9:43, where Jesus says, "And if thy hand offend thee, cut it off. If your limb offends you," in other words, if it causes you to sin and causes you to offend, "cut it off. For it is better for thee to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go to hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched." So, I think that's something very, you can consider the two things together, where Christ restored maimed people, and then also gave doctrine that says if your hand is such that it will prevent you from going to heaven, get rid of it. So I think the two, I don't mean to be funny, go hand in hand, one with the other, but one makes the other more understandable and certainly more acceptable, because God is able to do all things. Believing that and moving on, Jesus does in fact multiply the loaves and the fishes and feeds 4,000. We'll read down through, starting in Mark 8, down through verse 9. "In those days, the multitude being very great, and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him, and saith unto them, I have compassion on the multitude, because they have now been with me 3 days, and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for divers of them came from far. And his disciples answered him, From whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness?" Once again, let me make the observation that, frankly, these have to be the dumbest disciples the world has ever known. Having witnessed the feeding of the 5,000, sooner or later you would have thought that they would be catching on. Having witnessed the making whole of the maimed and all the other miracles that they have been witness to, but the hardness of their hearts and all other things. It's funny the way that people are. Short memories, I guess. But meanwhile, and Jesus asked them, "How many loaves have ye?" And they said, 7. And he commanded the people to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks and brake, and gave to his disciples to set before them. And he did set them before the people, and they had a few small fishes, and he blessed and commanded to set them also before them. So they did eat and were filled, and they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets. And they that had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. So once again, we see the multiplying of the physical with, and it's not a it's not an act of God that is beyond belief in any particular way. You know, scientists and even those who aren't creationists, but rather those who try to explain creation by means of the Bible, but subscribe to a scientific means, don't understand that God can multiply the physical at his very will. He can create something out of nothing, and then again make nothing out of something. So the physical is at his very whim, and in an instant can make some, you know, can make the entire universe or take the entire universe away. They're trying to make excuses for the supposed findings of science. It's too bad. Creation science, or whatever it's called, tries to make excuses for what science supposedly knows, and they need not do that. All they need to do is explain that all the answers are right here in the Bible, and all you need to do is believe. Well, after this event, the Pharisees then desire to have a sign, and they want a sign from heaven. Straightway, Mark 8:10, he entered into a ship with his disciples and came into the parts of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came forth and began to question with him, seeking of him a sign from heaven and tempting him. Of course, the temptation for Jesus, him being God manifest in the flesh, but also being fully man, man has a desire to for vanity and all that. Most of us, I would have to say all of us, if we had the same powers and abilities as God, we would want to show those off and make the Pharisees eat crow and all that. But meanwhile, so that's a temptation for Jesus, obviously, because he was fully man. But resisting that temptation, more than I could have done, I'm certain of that. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and saith, why doth this generation seek after a sign? Verily I say unto you, there shall no sign be given unto this generation. Now, for those of you who are familiar with the Bible, which I would say includes most of you listening to me right now, Mark says there's going to be no sign given unto this generation. And the Pharisees were asking for a sign from heaven. Mark is correct in saying that. You might say, well, I know that there is going to be a sign given, that being the sign of Jonas. And we read that in Matthew, because he adds that there's going to be a sign of the times, and that would be of the sign of the prophet Jonas. So who's right? Is it Mark or is it Matthew? That's going, you know, one says there's going to be a sign, the other says there's not going to be a sign. Do they agree or do they disagree? The fact of the matter is that they agree perfectly, one with the other. So Mark says there shall be no sign given unto this generation. Let's read what Matthew has to say in Matthew 16, verse 4. Matthew says that the Lord tells the Pharisees and Sadducees, a wicked and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given unto it. So Matthew says the same thing as Mark, that there will be no sign given unto that generation. But Matthew also adds that the Lord said there will be the sign of the prophet Jonas. So there will be no sign from heaven given to that wicked and adulterous generation that Jesus was speaking to. No sign from heaven whatsoever, but there will be the sign of the prophet Jonas. And he left them and departed. Now, the sign of the prophet Jonas is not hard to understand. It is, in fact, the Lord speaking about his death. And we recently studied the book of Jonah. It was an interesting book, short book, but very interesting. The reason it's so interesting, besides other reasons, is that it contains Jonah, chapter 1, verse 17. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Now that's what the Lord was referring to, was the 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. And the Lord clarifies and defines the sign of the prophet Jonah in his own words there in Matthew chapter 12, verse 40, that the same would be true for himself. Not that he would be swallowed by a fish, but rather, he says, for as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so obviously Jonah was not just a story, but rather a true and real life event. The Lord goes on and says, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. So the one thing that you find out for a fact is that the same happened to Jonas. The time element would be the same time element for Jesus Christ being in the heart of the earth or buried in the tomb 3 days and three nights, which doesn't bode well for the most Christians' time accounting of a Good Friday and Sunday resurrection, if you count that. Certainly not 3 days and three nights. So for those of you who hear this message and are celebrating Good Friday and Easter Sunday morning resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, you need to get another calendar. So in the whale's belly, Jonas 3 days and three nights, in the heart of the earth, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, 3 days and three nights. And that's the sign. All this generation here needs the same sign, and it needs to learn how to count. So there you go, and we'll stop right there and pick up in the same place in chapter 8 next time.